Hello everyone, welcome to LTV Talks. Today we have Nina Pollux with us. Nina and I have met about 6 years ago when she was still working at Bubble. And Nina comes with a 10-year plus experience in CRM industry. First at Bubble, and I believe like she stayed there for about 10 years, working right from getting her first experience to becoming a director of CRM. Bubble, for anyone who might not know, is a subscription-based language learning app based here in Berlin. And she recently took on a role as the senior director of CRM and lifecycle at Paramount. And of course, Paramount, everyone knows, but if someone is still doubtful, Paramount is an American subscription video on demand over the top streaming service, and they're still making their way into Germany. So with that, Nina, welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi everyone, glad to be here. Thanks Karen for having me. Yeah, like you said, it's funny how you cross paths with people in the Berlin CRM world. It's pretty small, so you tend to meet people again and again. And yeah, so glad I can be here and have a chat with you today about CRM. Yeah, as you said, I've been doing this for a little over 10 years now. I started at Bubble. Had no clue what it was when I started there. I basically just I had to Google it, what is CRM, before my job interview there as a trainee. But I got the job and I learned from there. And I'm still fascinated by it every day, which is why I'm still a very passionate email marketer and CRM marketer and customer engager. And after my time at Bubble, almost 10 years, I'm now leading CRM for the German speaking market, Germany, Austria, Switzerland for Paramount Plus. As you said, new streaming service, still fairly new streaming service, competitor to Netflix, Amazon Prime Video, Disney Plus, now on the German market since December last year. If you're a Star Trek fan, you probably already know it, and you probably already subscribe because we have almost all the Star Trek there and tons of other great things. So there's a 1 week free trial, so you can check it out if you haven't done so.
That's super nice. That's a very good pitch, Nina. I use it for my German learning still. So I do watch a lot of series on there just to watch everything in German, every content that I typically watch. So it's a nice service, and it's great to have you here. I think you're right. It's a very small world. And mm-hmm. The time we met, we were talking about onboarding and retention strategies. And this time when we met, I think like after a huge amount of time, we were still talking about that. And so both me and Nina actually thought that a great topic for the discussion today could be just like misconceptions and typical things that come up in CRM, and just go through some of the main topics that were maybe spoken about in conferences or in the industry long back, but still carry on to be discussed. And of course, we don't have the answers, otherwise these topics would cease to exist. But the idea is to talk about, to tap into Nina's extensive, you know, experience in this domain as well, and to get insights onto like what's actually happening versus on all of these topics. So with that, some topics that we have in mind for today are talking about CRM strategy, personalization, gamification. Should you be optimizing subject lines for its length? Should you be really working on that email design update that you think will change the world? And much more. So Nina, do you want to kick us off with one topic? How should we do it? Should I throw a topic at you discussing?
Maybe I can already pick up the last one that you just mentioned with the email design that will change the world. I think spoiler alert is that it probably won't, right? And I think this topic of misconceptions around email marketing is so interesting, because what you probably know, if you're an email marketer and you work in a company, your work is out there, right? Pretty much everyone is probably subscribed to your newsletter, and everyone has an opinion about it because everyone receives newsletters and everyone thinks they know how it's done. And then they come to you with the most basic idea or the basic complaint, where you who has been working in this job for a while think like, obviously we cannot do this, or obviously we have tried and it didn't work, or whatever. So I'm always fascinated by how much people think they know and how little they know in reality, because a lot of things are actually not as straightforward as you would think. And the design is one of them. I once heard someone say, I think it was actually someone pretty high ranking at Duolingo. I listened to a podcast once, and she was saying, actually, what I think is the biggest waste of time is optimizing email designs. And I would, to some extent, I would agree, because we always have to think about how long do people look at our email, right? And as long as that there's just one message, this email that we're sending has one job and one job only, and this job needs to be communicated in a visually clear way. There needs to be a very clear call to action. It needs to be very clear what happens if you click on this button, and that's it. And it doesn't matter how many flashy images are in there. It doesn't matter the copy you put in there very often. It doesn't really matter the tone of voice that you have in your long text that no one will read anyway. In my experience, companies spend a lot of time on these things, and in the end, they don't really matter. And especially because if you think about designs, like think about websites and think about tools you're using, and when these tools have their big redesign, how often do you go in there and think, oh, that's awesome, that's just what I have been waiting for? It's not, right? You think like, what the F, like, where's this button used to be here and now it's somewhere else, and now I have to, you know, if it was clunky, you got used to using it and you knew where things were, and now everything is different and people don't like change, and that's annoying, right? So in my experience, the change in design almost always leads to a worse response rate in the beginning, at least, unless you have something that gets a boost through a novelty effect and then also tapers off later on. So, obviously, if you're rebranding your entire everything you have, all your assets, your logo, your whatever, even have a different name, obviously, you have to go with it. And then also, if you are in this position, then there's often the question, do we test? Do we A-B test the design?
That's a big one, yeah.
I would think, like, you know, ask yourself, what if the test comes back negative? Is there an option to not do it? Like, is there an option to say we keep the old logo and the old company name in our email because that performs better? If you answer that question with no, just, you know, hold your nose, close your eyes, and change the design and hope for the best, then a test is just a waste of time. It's just knowing how big the pain is going to be. That would be my learning. If you want to define a range of, like, this is the negative impact that we're willing to accept, and if it's worse, then we're rethinking the whole thing, then you know, maybe test. Otherwise, just go for it.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of great points within that as well, and something that keeps coming up. For example, if you look at some of the major brands like Amazon or a Bumble or Duolingo, even for that matter, their emails are super basic, right? Like, it's just like one line. This is what happened. If it's Bumble, it's like someone liked you. They don't say anything, nothing, just one CTA, no photos, no, you know, glam. So to a certain extent, I think there's a realization with these bigger brands that, okay, you know, people use it for our, they know what to expect from the product and they know what we are saying. So we don't need to really be very visually appealing. Whereas for other brands, which are maybe talking more about furniture design or, you know, something where it does rely on how it looks and there's certain brand quotient. Yeah. Maybe it makes sense to spend some time there, but not too much, right? Like, it's not going to be the thing that makes or breaks your campaigns. I hope not. Yeah. And I think one last point that you mentioned is also very interesting around testing it. Because even if that definitely should clear things up, right? Like, what if the test loses? What can you do, really?
Yeah.
And also, sometimes with these tests, like, you are underestimating the work that goes into, like, the future reporting of these campaigns to, you know, to get all the team in one room to discuss the results, right? So there are all these time costs that you're actually incurring when you are putting out live a test. And so email design probably is one of the lowest impact test, right? That you can run.
And it's one of the most difficult to pull off. So yeah, the return on time invested there. Yeah.
Also, the hypothesis on these ones are quite weak, right? Like if you're optimizing the email design, unless you're doing like an AMP for email or something interactive, etc., the hypothesis is typically quite basic, right? Like below the fold, above the fold sort of things. And
exactly. Yeah, I think this is one of the things that just marketers like to do, because we get so good at being marketers and that we get worse at being customers. And I think we get caught up at like, this is the newest, latest, coolest thing. And this is a newsletter from company XYZ that I've seen and that I really, really liked and that I think is visually appealing, or things like that. And then we just get carried away and we think we have to try it out because, or maybe again, you know, maybe your superior has seen this email from another company and says, why aren't our emails looking like that? And then you, you have a really hard time convincing them of like, look, we can change it, but it's not going to do anything. It's just going to cost us time.
Yeah, that's a very valid point. Actually, in most of the cases that I have seen these type of requests come in, they are from either like the founder or the C-level, where they were on the train or in their taxi or whatever, and they saw like one email and then suddenly there's a thought like, okay, why is my company not doing this? Exactly. And then the army of CRM goes on to execute and change all the campaigns with no or less impact, right? So
exactly.
That is very true. On the similar line, I think, what do you think about subject line testing? And, you know, like, what are some of the misconceptions or things that frustrate you with subject line testing? I have my own views as well, but I'd love to hear yours.
Yeah, I'd love to hear yours too. So my view on subject lines and subject line testing changed completely and I don't necessarily need to do free advertising here for a company, but we used a company that specializes in AI-based copywriting and providing subject lines based on tons of data points and insights of what works best, and they create emotional profiles of your customer base, etc. So and that was quite interesting. And what we observed there is actually that just by having a different subject line, we could not just, like you would think, the only thing that impacts is the open rate, right? But what we saw that this, it was actually trailing down to the sale. So just by having a different subject line, we would get, in some cases, a significant uplift in sales as well. And when we think about what are best practices in subject lines, usually people would say it needs to be short, right? Because you need to see it, because there's only a short preview, and you only need to, you know, the first words need to count. But again, like often the subject lines that won in these tests that made the most sales, not just the highest open rate, and sometimes the effect even got stronger down the line through the clicks and to the sale, they were two lines long, these subject lines. It was insane. Like this was a subject line no human would have ever devised. And I couldn't explain it, to be honest, because you don't see it. But then I was thinking maybe it is because if you think about you opening the email on your phone, and then at least when you have Apple Mail on an iPhone, then you open the email and then the subject line is actually in bold and it's at the very top and you see it in bold. And then if it's a long subject line, it just goes across your whole screen. It's basically that's your email, this long subject line. And that maybe that's the case. Otherwise, I don't know. But I would just say, you know, go for it. Like, don't try to try a longer subject line. Try something very odd. Use a ChatGPT or whatever to, you know, come up with something that a human wouldn't come up with, because quite often you could be surprised. And yeah, not just for the open rate, but you could actually increase all your main KPIs even further down the funnel just by having a different subject line. So that's definitely highly relevant to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a very interesting insight as well, because subject line testing is one of the more optimizable quotients of an email, right?
And very simple.
With this AI tool, right? Like, was there anything content wise that they changed? Because in my opinion, what has worked really well is that if you can afford to do it, like if it doesn't go against your brand guidelines and so on, something that has worked really well is tapping into the core need that a user has, right? Like, so for example, if you are, let's say, a language learning app, you are helping a user to learn the language, right? But there is one layer deeper reason why a user wants to learn the language. It might be to fit into a new culture. It might be to explore a new culture, right? And so as soon as you go that one layer deep and you talk to that value proposition, I have seen subject lines start performing better and better, and you can be playful about it, right? Like, if you're in Germany, you can relate with a lot of things around, like, Burgeramt, for instance, right? Like, so a subject line that talks about make your Burgeramt experience a lot less stressful might do better, because, you know, you instantly relate to it at a very core level versus something where I say, hey, you know, we are going to help you learn German faster. So was that the content switch that you think made the difference, or was it actually purely just length and making your point within that length as well?
I'm not sure it was length. I think in this case, it was really the not so much tapping into the content, but tapping into the emotions. Like, they would also classify, and this is something that you could also do. You know, you can, you don't have to buy a partner for that. If this is a, you can just apply that concept of thinking about, okay, the concept of exclusivity, for example. You want to highlight that, hey, this is just for you, or you have been picked, or something like that. I mean, some of those subject lines were weird and we were not sure we wanted to use them, but those were often the best performing ones. And of course, then you have to think about, does this fit your brand at all? And so on. But, or things like fear, like don't miss out, or optimism, like you want to gain something, like this is an awesome opportunity. It was more those things. I think with the content, especially for language learning, what I found in my years at Babbel, in the end, the motivations are, you can classify them into, and we try to, you know, this is a person learning because they want to travel and want to have a better experience while traveling. This is someone who wants to learn for having better career opportunities, maybe even moving to a different country. This is someone who is learning in a new language to communicate with family members, maybe of a spouse or ancestors, like, you know, the grandma living in Italy or whatever. But at the end of the day, it is almost too specific to and too individual to really have a subject line that fits. So you would have to be so segmented in your subject lines, you know, because the Bürgeramt is, it applies to a lot of people, but it would still be a small percentage probably. And you would really have to find a lot of these. I think if you find the right one, that is definitely, you know, the gold star subject line, but it is hard to find the right one. So I think a good approach is something to is tap into the emotions, because they're probably a bit more common than the specific reason to learn a language. So this is something that I would recommend to explore.
By the way, talking about misconceptions and this particular example, one thing that came to mind was, or actually two things that came to mind. One was when I was doing my MBA, I remember like this very basic marketing fundamentals that we also don't apply sometimes in the app world, which is, you know, if you're working on a segmentation problem, you want to make sure that the segment is sizable enough, right? Like it's big enough that it's applicable to a lot of them. And on that same point, the Burgeramt example that I made actually is a very big problem in the industry, right? Because I could make that example and show you the value of personalization, but then there is a deeper layer of it, right? Like, where, how many people does that apply to, and how many people would actually gain out of any value out of it, or is tapping into their core needs? And that's where I feel like always, you know, in conferences, I could give that example and make my point and seem like a very smart person who knows how to do it. But I think that's where everyone drops off, right? Because you listen to these personalization examples, even if it's a Duolingo or whatever, and then you kind of don't know how to go about it, because you don't even know what the sizable segmentation looks like and what's the value proposition for, right? Would you agree to that? Or do you think it's relatively easy to get to these bigger enough points and value propositions within your messaging as well?
I think that depends. That really depends on the case. Like for example, let's stick with the Bürgeramt example.
Yeah.
So then if you, I agree, it's probably a big segment, right? But then the next question needs to be, can you even find these people? How would you find, you know, which data points do you have that could tell you, is this the Bürgeramt case or not? Like you could, like if I think about, okay, maybe I'm now looking for everyone who is in Germany, but does not have German as their language set, but maybe is learning German. That could be a good case, right? This is obviously someone who does not speak German well enough to use the product in German and obviously wants to learn German. So that looks like an expat case who's interested in learning the language here. And that could be. And then you can count the segment and see, is that even worth it? Then you can even briefly run the numbers. Okay, your segment is so and so big. If you increase your click rate, your conversion rate by so and so much, what's the value that you could get out of there, etc. And this is what we often did. For example, whenever we had localization requests for certain countries, to look like, okay, how many people do you actually have in this country? How many people do we have in this country who actually speak the language in this country? Like we had, there are countries like Sweden, for example, where most people are not Swedish speaking. Swedish is actually one of the most learned languages in Sweden because it's actually an expat product. So you need to calculate, can you even, you know, do you get a proper return on investment? If you think about how much time will it take you to localize for this segment, etc. I mean, if it's just a subject line, you know, it's easy. You can just try it out. Like, let's just send the Bürgeramt subject line to the segment that we just found and see what it does and test it against the standard one. That's an easy one. You know, if it's something simple and quick, always go for it and see, maybe there's something there. But if it's something more substantial, then it always makes sense to run the numbers. And if you realize that you actually can't run the numbers because you actually don't even know how to target this segment enough to be sure enough that you have a lot of people in there, then it gets difficult. Then I think that's a sign that maybe this is not a segment to pursue further.
Yeah. And in a lot of cases, I've also seen that lifecycle teams or CRM teams don't even have that depth of data within their segments.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's also very difficult to be just at that level where you can clearly target these users.
Exactly. And then the question is, is it reproducible? Yeah. Like you said, maybe it's a manual data pull that you can do once. And then you can prove a concept. But then it's the question, can you make this data so readily available that this becomes something that you can automate, and that also often is a no, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I think I hope we are not venting and people don't think it's just like bad. And I mean, there are some good examples, but I think unfortunately that's the majority still. One insight from your experience so far before we move on to the next misconception is, within your time from, like, you know, within the last, let's say, 12 or maybe even like 5 to 5 years and after, have you seen changes in this level of sophistication within companies? For instance, have you seen companies more and more having this sort of availability of this data versus how, when you started? Like, how do you compare and how do you see the industry in terms of like just sophistication on data points and getting all the information within CRM tools, and also CRM teams being able to effectively utilizing these points?
Yeah, I think I definitely saw a change there. I think the industry is growing up slowly but surely, which may even have to do with the fact that startups tend to be a similar age somehow. You know, it's like there was a startup boom and obviously there are new ones coming and old ones leaving all the time. But I have the feeling that more or less ish, you can, you know, you have these, the first generation, the second generation, etc., and they're all now like 15, 10 or so years old. And I think along with that also goes the customer base that they have. And they are now just starting to realize that it's not just about the next first ever sale that I'm making, because there's only so many people you can reach for the first time. And obviously, I don't have to tell this to anyone who's doing CRM, that the value is in the life cycle, right? No matter which, whether it's a subscription or retail or whatever it is, it's always easier to get more money and more sales from people you already have convinced once than, unless they had a completely shitty experience, right? Usually it's much, much easier than acquiring a new customer. I think that's known. And I think along with that, with the audience and the customer base maturing, comes this realization and this awareness of, okay, we need to do something for them. And I at least have the feeling that CRM has actually become, I know we briefly talked about it before, how everybody's always saying email is dead and so on. But of course, CRM is also much more than just email. And there are new channels coming all the time and new forms of communication. And I think it's becoming more and more important. And I think companies are realizing that and they're willing to invest more. The tools that are out there, be it Braze, be it Salesforce, be it Emarsys, whatever, they get more and more sophisticated. They offer more and more out of the box solutions as well. But at the end of the day, the tool is always as good as your data implementation is. And if the tool doesn't have any data, then you can't do anything with it. And one thing I've also seen is that this resource of, they have different names from company to company, but at Bubble, we used to call them CRM tech and data managers. You can call them solution architects, I've heard, or that's what we have now at Paramount Plus or other things. But this is someone who really understands the tech and who can really communicate with between the marketers and the engineers, and who can really champion the tech needs and the ideas and the requests of the CRM team to the engineering department. And these people, they're still extremely hard to find. So if you have one, you're lucky. but they become more and more common and more and more in demand because it's just if you automate processes in the right way, you can either save, you know, on the campaign management side, and I don't mean that we don't need campaign managers anymore, of course I would want no one to lose their job, but we can enable campaign managers to do other things. Like, probably if you're a CRM campaign manager, you probably spend most of your time on very repetitive manual tasks of implementing, copy pasting stuff here and there, QAing things like reading tracking codes, tracking parameters, et cetera, et cetera. That's what we spend most of our time, pretty much most of our time in many cases, I think. And if we could just automate many of these things and make more data points available, we could do so much smarter campaigns. We could send more varied campaigns, more relevant campaigns, and thus enable the campaign managers, the campaign management team that we have, to be much, much more effective and efficient. So, and I do see this changing very slowly. It still needs a lot of convincing, but again, in the case of Bubble, when I left, we just had hired actually a dedicated CRM engineering team. Which I hope now is a huge unlock for the team. Can't say, I'm not there anymore, but and this is something that I hear more and more frequently.
Yeah, that's very true. And I completely agree on the CRM tech role as well. I've seen that just having that dedicated resource in the team is much more powerful a lever than what it was 3 years ago, because also these tools have become way more sophisticated and you can do so much more if you have a technical resources hand, right? Like, you can just like completely scale without hiring a ton of people in your CRM campaign management team.
Exactly.
And also they get more strategical.
That's just career advice here. If you're a CRM manager and you have any interest in any, you know, if you're a tech person as well, like this is the way to go. Like, trust me.
Absolutely.
You're gonna make big money in the future if you.
I actually know someone at who works at Flink now, and he's very talented in the CRM tech space.
Yeah.
So anyway, I'm going to send this to him and hopefully make his day.
maybe I need to hire him. Maybe give me his contacts. If he's not happy with Flink anymore. Let's see.
Absolutely. There's this, you know, with these tech integrations, I think like one other misconception that I wanted to bring up using that is personalization and gamification. So, you know, what have been your experiences in that space? I have seen personally that I can see the need for it, right? There's a strong business case for it. But the problem for me is that personalization is too broad, right? Like you have companies at a level where we are not even using, for example, first name is a very defamed case of personalization now. But I think like even that, right? Or moving beyond that to segmentation and, you know, having more segmented flows, etc. So what is your view on personalization? And then we can talk about gamification as well.
Yeah. Good question. It's again, I would say really see what's the true value. I think personalization again is one of these things similar to the design, where you think you have to do it, and where you look at the data you have and then you think of what you can do with it. It's also something you tend to get carried away with the data you have, and then you think about what to do with it, and then you may end up just doing personalization for the sake of doing personalization. I'm always careful of doing things just for the sake of doing them, just because everybody else is doing them or because we can. So usually I think the better way to do this is to look at what you would want to do, what you would think you need to do, and then ask yourself, what data do you need in order to do that? Definitely for a retail company, for example, personalization is probably more relevant than for, again, going back to the bubble example where I was already saying it is sometimes hard to find big enough, you know, personalization opportunities according to what is your personal need to learn this language. We can to some extent, but it often won't move the needle enough to be worth the effort. Of course, if you think about retail, you know, your clothing brand, it starts with, are you male or female? Are you interested in male or female clothes? Is it summer? Is it winter? It's not really personalization, but maybe depending on where you are, maybe it's a global company and in some parts of the world it's winter and some parts of the world it's summer. Have you shown interest in certain categories, etc. That is probably much more interesting to invest in personalization there and recommendation capabilities, etc. But also it also needs to be done in a smart way. I think we all know the example of you once researched a washing machine, a laundry machine, and then eventually you bought one, but then you keep being retargeted with washing machines, right? And then how many washing machines are you going to buy? It's personalized because obviously I used to have an interest once, but I don't have this interest anymore. So now maybe show me a dishwasher liquid or, you know, like laundry detergent or something like that. So then is again, like, can we track whenever a purchase has actually happened? Obviously not when it has been with a different company. I think there are limits to that. It's definitely something, especially for retail, it needs to change at some point. It needs to end at some point. You need to find something else to show if there just hasn't been a purchase of this one thing. I think it really depends on what's your product, how many options do you have to show. If it's really just, if the use cases are limited or the applications are limited, if for a language learning app, it's just about do a lesson today. I think it's enough to just be there in the inbox as regularly as possible. And it doesn't really matter too much with which language, because with which message, because hopefully the learner will themselves remember why they sign up to learn a language and will be then motivated by their own motivation, whichever that may be. If yeah, if it's something else, then it may be more interesting for sure to show a more personalized selection of items. For example, for Paramount Plus, we're going kind of a medium route. We have some content that we want to show everybody because we also believe it has mass appeal. But then obviously there's also, you know, maybe you're a horror movie fan, maybe you're a comedy series fan, you like sitcoms or whatever. And of course, if we know that, then we can recommend you things accordingly. And obviously that would perform better than just recommending everyone the same thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there are such good points that, and such important points that we get wrong, or sometimes we even overthink in personalization.
Mm-hmm, yeah, one, exactly.
One thing I was thinking about when you were talking about this washing machine example is I was once shopping for my wife and I got her a dress on her birthday, or it was our anniversary, I don't remember. But as soon as I did that, the company started sending me all these discounts on women wear, right? And I thought to myself, like, it could be solved in I can't believe it's only me who has this use case where I was buying something as a gift, even for kids, right? Like, you would buy something as a gift or for your husband or your wife. And what I thought was only if they had a simple toggle, right, where they said this is a gift, so that they know that they can market for themselves. Not only the date when I bought it, because it's typically a good date for me to, you know, to buy again.
Buy something
but
similar,
also to know that, you know, maybe they can promote matching clothes, or I don't know what people are into. But yeah, something like that, right? So you could use that information much more richer way. So there's a big ROI on collecting data like that.
Yeah, that's true, for example.
Yeah, and another point that I had on the washing machine example is, like, it's all about relationship building as well, right, for these apps. So if I bought a couch from IKEA, and if 1 month later I understand the pressure to communicate with me because you might think there's some more value, purchase value that can come out of a user. But I always tend to think that it's you're way better off sending them a reminder, something like, it's been 1 month since you bought your couch. These are some really handy tips that can make it last longer, right? Like, that helps me build such higher value for that brand that I might come and repeat my purchase just because I know that the brand cares that I'm making the most out of that and not pushing me another sale, right? So, but it's a long game, right? It's hard to prove impact. It's hard to prove. And that's overall as a business value. So it's more
difficult.
That's
a good point, because I think a lot of companies would actually stop at, okay, the guy has bought a couch once, let's offer more couches. And it sounds very stupid if you think it like that, and if you imagine, but that's often what I see in different examples, right? And it's like, obviously, the couch is the last thing you should offer now, right? Because the couch has just been bought. So offer whatever, couch pillows or a table or, you know, whatever, a picture to hang over the couch or whatever it is, but not the couch. But yeah, I see this very often and it's always interesting.
And it's very hard to prove value for these things. I think that's why it's never been developed to a level, because you can't prove the value right away, and it's very hard to see, okay, did someone buy again in like 1 year or something, right? Like, it's very tough thing to do, but it's just something good to have, not good, something that you can prove necessarily, I guess. One last point, I guess, like, one last, we have time for one more misconception or one thing that has been bloated in the industry. For me, that pick is gamification, but I can give you a few options if you have better ones that you want to talk about. So our options are gamification, is CRM marketing or product function, and A/B testing. Which one do you want to pick?
Let me think what I know most misconceptions about. A/B testing is great. I don't have many misconceptions about that. Except, again, don't just test for the sake of testing. Like, if you have a campaign where it is obvious what the best way to run this campaign is, don't just try to force a test out of it. And also, if you test, make sure you actually generate learnings that are applicable for the future, not just for this one campaign that is now over. And then you know in hindsight what would have been the best way to do it all along, but try to make those tests generalizable to the future. This is, I think, something I see done wrong pretty often, where it's like, okay, that's a great result, and what now? And then it's often like, So I think this spending those extra 10 minutes before a test is started into, okay, what do we do with this after, if this test goes one or the other way or is flat, I think is time well spent. The gamification is interesting. I would be interested why you bring that up, what you think about it. I think it's whenever you can do it. I think, again, don't just force it. And if it has nothing to do and no feasible application with your business and your product, don't just force it because everybody's doing it. But I've seen some creative ways with non-gamification products, where be it simple things like a scratch-off deal or things like that, everything. Just a stupid quiz where just hiding something behind a button and people will click on it because people are completionists and they're curious. So if there's a good idea, it's always good to try it out. But what do you think about gamification, Karen?
I think it's a bit, I would love to see more examples of it being done well. Other than Duolingo, yeah. Right? Like, for example, everyone, I think, piggybacks on Duolingo as the reason why we should have gamification. At least in a lot of calls that I've been, I've always seen that is the use case. And then I ask them for three more use cases and people don't usually have them. because there is nothing that has been done effectively. To be honest, yeah. I would argue there's a very big cognitive overload. And funnily, I just am recollecting with gamification. Fun fact is 15 years ago. No, I remember when Coursera was just launched. My first course was on gamification by this professor at Wharton. And this was like long, long back. And we used it in a school where we used to write, or we used to make the teachers write the leaderboard on who is leading in terms of attendance, in terms of who's coming to the school. And it worked wonders, right? So I totally am a strong believer that it can work. But for subscription apps, I feel it's very hard to translate that into something that is also a user feels motivated to do, right? Because otherwise, there's too much. I downloaded an app called Finch recently, and because it was promoted as one of these apps which are really good, really well designed from a gamification perspective, and there was too much going on. There were streaks, there was milestones, there were this bird you have to take care of, and I thought I had to spend 24 hours in that app just to manage, and it was too much, right? And that's my beef with gamification, but I'm a strong believer in it, in the concept.
But also, another good example that goes in a similar direction, I think it's is that now everybody's trying to copy the Spotify Wrapped, the year in review, which is which I think is the most anticipated email campaign in the world that is sent once a year, that everybody who's a user of Spotify is looking forward to, which is a great achievement in itself. But now everybody is like, we have to do a year in review for everyone. And then you get the weirdest, all of a sudden you hear from a company you haven't heard of in however long. And then you get to hear like, you did this and this, you bought so and so much, and you did so and so many minutes of whatever it is. And sometimes it works, like, going back to Duolingo, Bubble, probably it works. If you have actually engaged with that app, I think, in the ed tech or fitness apps also know that they have probably, they once take a look into their database and realize that most, they probably don't want to send that email to many customers who then will actually learn that they got no value out of this product that they've been paying for all year because they were not using it, because that's unfortunately what these types of apps are struggling with, right? This effect of you're excited and invested in the beginning, and then that it's hard to build a habit. This is another thing.
I have a very good free campaign idea for you at Paramount. You should do an anti-wrapped email where you say, well, you know, we tried looking into the data, we didn't find anything, and honestly, we just think you're better off watching more movies than revising what you have already seen, and just go like completely extremely opposite.
Yeah. It's actually to do like, this is all the time you missed watching something awesome. This is like, you spend way too much time with your friends and, you know, socializing and being outside.
And you should flip and wrap the emails on its head, you know, completely.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, this has nothing to do with anything, but this is just always like my favorite campaign that I ever got was from some fashion brand, and it was a birthday email, but it was sent after my birthday. And then it was, oh no, we forgot your birthday. We're so sorry.
Very nice.
I just thought it was brilliant because, first of all, I know there's no way they didn't know my birthday was the day before because, you know, they know. They know it. But then because usually on your birthday, you're busy with other things, right? You don't look at your emails all day long. So the emails that are sent on the day are, they tend to get buried anyway. Then you get a lot of birthday emails. So they're also out of that whole mess. And there's a personal touch. I mean, who doesn't love an apology email? Whoever had to send one once knows they tend to work really well. They give it a personal touch. Everybody knows what it's like to forget a birthday. So I think that was brilliant. If I ever work at a company where we actually collect people's birthdays, I'm going to do that one.
I might steal that idea as well. This is crazy. And one of my, on the birthday themes, I remember, like, there's a brand called High Design in India, and they do like wallets and purses and whatnot made out of leather. And it's a very, like, it's a good premium brand, right? And what they do is when your birthday is just your birthday month, I think, they give you, I think, like 50 or 60% off on all their products. So you can buy anything but once a year. And they don't send you any like text message or whatever. There's actually a representative that calls you and tells you, hey, you know, it's your birthday month. We realize that it's a special month. Please don't forget that you can actually avail this offer. And we'd love for you to have this, right? So I felt that was very, I mean, I realized that it's very high effort, probably high impact as well for them to be able to do it. But it could work. Probably. Very nice. So I guess like that's all our misconceptions within CRM. And it was super fun talking to you about all of these topics. I feel like we could, I never realized that we were almost an hour into it. So definitely up for doing it again to vent out on our industry.
We had a little hiccup in between, but I mean, I'm up for a part two. You know, maybe you can also, I don't know, maybe your audience, your listeners can also send some, and then we can discuss them.
Absolutely. That would be very cool.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Nina. And any parting words before we end the recording?
I just hope someone took something away from this. If you're struggling with your boss or whatever to make your point on one of these things, then maybe show them this and say there are, you know, two people who've been here a long time and who say the same thing as me, and maybe that helps them convince, like, not, you know, spend your whole time on a design test of a rebrand that you won't be able to change anyway. If that helps one person, then my job here is done. So then I'm happy.
Yeah. And if you're into CRM tech, do reach out to Nina because she might be hiring you.
I'm always looking, or at least I always know someone who's looking. So that's a good job to learn.
Cool.
Definitely lots of fun. Looking forward to maybe doing it again.
Cool. Thank you so much, Nina, again. And I will link out to your LinkedIn so people can reach out to you and bother you with more questions. But I'll definitely let Sherry live around too soon. Thank you.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks. Bye, guys.